Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, March 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us. Dr. Rapson is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta, and she is here to answer your questions about space, constellations, comets, anything else in the final frontier. Give us a call at 800-348-2551 if you have an astronomy question, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. The number again, though, is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today. Dr. Valerie Rapson takes your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us. Dr. Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta, and she earned her PhD in astrophysical sciences and technology from RIT. Her research focused on the structure and composition of planet-forming disks around nearby young stars. Dr. Rapson spent 5 years developing and teaching astronomy education programs for the Dudley Observatory and is now an assistant professor in the physics and astronomy department at SUNY Oneonta. If you have a question about the heavens, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. It's nice and sunny here in Oneonta today, so I'm a happy woman.
Very nice to see the sun again and feel a little warmth, so that is a good thing. What is the latest update on the Mars rover that has been roving around now for a little while?
Yeah, everything seems to be good. You know, we get new pictures daily and updates from NASA, and so far, so good. Everything checks out. Batteries are charging. All is well with the rover.
Do they know when they will attempt to launch the drone?
Oh, yeah, they've been talking about it. So the drone is right now charging up its batteries. It has to charge to like 35% using the onboard computers and whatnot with Perseverance. Then it will be placed on the ground and use its own solar panels to charge up and then fly. So unfortunately, it's got a little while. We probably won't see it fly for another month, if not longer. I think originally they targeted May. But maybe it'll happen sooner.
Well, it's very exciting, and it's always great to see. As far as the pictures I've seen so far, they don't seem that very much different from the pictures I've seen from the last couple of rovers. But we expect more data about possibility of life and organic materials and such.
Yeah, well, you know what's cool about the pictures is that the quality of the pictures is pretty much as good as what I can get with my cell phone, if not a little better. And while the pictures might look similar, they're just so much better than we've ever had before. And usually the technology is a lot older on the rover, so our phones will do better. Now it's comparable, so we really feel like we are standing there with the rover, seeing it as we would on Earth. But yeah, we're going to get a lot of great data back and a lot more close-up pictures soon, too.
Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And Rich in New Jersey wrote this, just about the time we started this show at 2 o'clock. Rich writes a question about water, actually more than one. Rich writes, I have read that the water on Earth was not created here but came from somewhere else. True?
Yes. Yeah, that is actually true. We don't think that a lot of the water on Earth started on Earth. We think it actually came from collisions, probably by asteroids, maybe by comets. But early on, we were hit by so many rocks that likely deposited the water and created our oceans on this planet. So yes, that is true.
Well, Rich follows up. If so, why could it not have been created here?
Because the Earth is too close to the sun. So if you think about it, the closer you are to the sun, the more easily molecules like water can evaporate, become gaseous, and then travel away into space. So Earth had to develop an atmosphere to be able to trap in the heat and create the right pressure to have liquid water on the surface. Then the water had to arrive and stay there. Had the water been there early on, most of it would have been evaporated. The H2O molecule would have separated from the UV light. And it would have basically traveled away into space. It wouldn't have been able to stay on the planet for very long.
Valerie Rapson joins us. Rich's final question might be one that is difficult for you to answer. Rich asks, I think I read once that it all came from comets, as you discussed. And Rich says, how many comets would it take to fill up our oceans?
A lot. How about that?
Over a long period of time.
Yeah, for sure. We don't really know a solid number, but it would take quite a few to create the amount of water we have today, for sure.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Let's start out the show with Cooper in New Paltz. Cooper, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to ask what kind of maybe career opportunities or prospective jobs that a soon-to-be astronomy graduate might want to try to pursue with an astronomy degree.
Yeah, there's so much you can do with an astronomy degree, especially things that you don't normally think of. I mean, obviously, there's a go work for NASA, go be an aerospace engineer, work for SpaceX, something like that. Education fields are always great. You can either do formal education at a college, informal education at a museum. And I know so many astronomers nowadays who actually go into data science because they're really good at problem solving and writing computer code. And so they work, you know, for maybe non-scientific companies, but they're, you know, plugging away at the data and they're doing marketing and that kind of stuff using the skills that they learned as an astronomer. So you can do pretty much anything with an astronomy degree. You get a lot of those great skills.
All right. Great. Great. Yeah. I remember hearing that I should be learning Python or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, Python is definitely good, but, you know, if you've studied astronomy, you've got all the skills to succeed in pretty much any job you want to go for.
Great. Hey, thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks, Cooper. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us. The number is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. We go to Sarah in Fultonville. Sarah, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
I appreciate your taking the call.
Sure.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. You're on.
Okay, great. I would like to know what you recommend, Doctor, to read for me to understand enough astrophysics so that I can communicate with my nephew, who just got a PhD and does research in astrophysics.
Oh, boy.
I think binary stars.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, I mean, he's got a PhD in astrophysics, so he's been studying it for a long time. But there's so many great magazines out there that, you know, you can at least catch up on all of the exciting things that are happening, the new discoveries in the astronomy world. And those are written in common language. So, you know, Sky and Telescope, Astronomy Magazine, all of that good stuff. And space.com, simple websites like that have a lot of great articles for the general public. So if you read a couple of those articles, you can definitely converse with him, and I'm sure they can share some more information about, you know, what's happening with these discoveries. That would be my suggestion.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. Is there a Astrophysics for Dummies book in your
There is quite a few of those types of books. Neil deGrasse Tyson has written a lot of books like that. I think his latest one is Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. So that's a really nice, shortened, condensed summary of everything you'd want to know about astrophysics.
He was actually on with Joe Donahue today during the roundtable. It was a fascinating interview, and he was talking about, you know, some of the different ways the universe could end. And, you know, and also there are questions that you just can't answer. I mean, you can speculate, but, I mean, does the universe have an end? What's your opinion?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a great question that you're right. Nobody really knows the answer to that yet. We can perceive an edge because we can only see so far, but beyond that, we don't have the ability to ever physically see it. We're just limited by the physical world. So my opinion, I don't know. I got to see some evidence that's going to sway me one way or the other before I can really decide.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, Dr. Bowery, I got a question for you.
Sure.
Every time I see a vapor trail, vapor trails, usually the vapor trail turns to like a reddish color, and then when I notice the plane coming over Great Barrington, the constellation vapor is going over the plane. What does that entail?
Well, The red coloring is likely from the fact that, you know, you've added additional cloud-like material up there. And when you have light passing through more material, you're going to scatter more of the bluish and the yellow colors. And the only light that's going to come through is the red light. So you're going to see the red coloring from that. And then my guess would be just kind of light scattering over the edge of the clouds might cause it to twinkle a little bit. And if you're seeing it in the evening, that might affect what you see in the stars in the sky.
Including the vapor trail?
Yeah, you'll still see the vapor trail, and you're going to get, you know, additional light either from the sun in the daytime or light, just naturally ambient light from the night sky there coming through.
And what about over the plane itself, the constellation?
Well, it depends on when you see it, right? The constellations change with every season, so if you saw one recently, you might have seen it, you know, pass through Orion or one of our winter sky constellations.
I saw one during midday hours.
Ah, all right.
Ah, interesting. Well, that's kind of unique. I don't know that you'd see any constellations during the day then. None of the stars up there are bright enough to see during the day, and even the planets right now are really too faint to see during the day. So
yeah.
Must have been some other light or twinkle in the sky.
I mean, if you see a constellation in the day, I think it's time to head for the bunker, frankly. Let's take a quick break. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy Today on the program. We are just getting started. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. How are things going at SUNY Oneonta, by the way?
They're going really well. Everybody is following the rules. The students are doing great. The faculty is, you know, being extra careful, and everything's going really smoothly this semester.
Well, that is terrific news. Great to hear. We go to Peter in Newburgh. Peter, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I'm not physically very able anymore due to some advanced age, but I would like to take some pictures of the Milky Way. And I'm wondering if you know of any places where I can get to fairly easily, maybe even with a car, that I can observe the Milky Way. Near me is the Bear Mountain State Park, but it closes at dusk. Do you have any suggestion for someone here in the Hudson Valley?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, a lot of the state parks, you're right, they do close at dusk, but you might want to check with the amateur astronomy clubs in the area, because sometimes they get special permission to go there after dark, because you're definitely going to want one of the state parks or somewhere away from just a normal suburban or city park to be able to see the Milky Way. There might be some places, too, where you can just kind of drive out to the rural area and, you know, hang out in somebody's field for a while. I've met some really great people where I've just pulled over and looked at the sky. They come out and they're like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "Checking out the Milky Way." And then we hang out for an hour and we're good. So I don't know that I have a specific great area for you, but I would check with the state parks. You might be able to stay later than you think. And then, you know, anywhere that's nice and dark would be a great view for you.
All right, Peter, thanks a lot for the call. So, Dr. Rapson, you spend a lot of time hanging around people's fields. That's interesting.
You know, I've gotten more brave in my older age here of like, I'm just going to go hang out here and get a good view of the sky. But everyone's so friendly. And if you bring a pair of binoculars and you let them look through the binoculars, they're fascinated. And then you get to do this like community astronomy and, you know, sometimes then they start inviting you back to hang out in the evening. So it's a lot of fun.
You know, that's fascinating that you say binoculars because, you know, I find it easier when looking at stars. I've told you this before, but I had a telescope and I was just terrible at sighting the thing and finding the stars I was looking for. But binoculars, yeah, you don't get the magnification, but there's a certain ease of use with them.
Yeah, definitely, because you're holding them right up to your eyes. So where you think you're looking is where the binoculars are looking. You don't have to kind of, you know, crouch down and line yourself up with the telescope. So they're really great. And I love to just, you know, slowly pan the sky with the binoculars in front of my eyes, because you catch things that you normally wouldn't see without that small additional magnification. So all of a sudden you'll be seeing a star cluster, or maybe you'll even catch Andromeda without even noticing it right away.
Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Don is in Amsterdam. Don, you're on.
Hello there.
Hello.
Two questions. I've been watching on YouTube and other internet sources some talks by the likes of Neil deGrasse Tyson, David Butler, mm-hmm. Fermilab, Michio Kaku. Can you recommend any other places I can go for these lectures?
Oh, yeah. So like you said, YouTube is a great place. There's tons of resources there. You can check out, there's a bunch of podcasts. I know, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson does the Star Talk podcast. And there's also documentary companies like The Great Courses, for example, where you can purchase either a subscription service, or you can just buy a couple of the astronomy-themed documentaries and learn a lot of great stuff there. So those are my suggestions. Check out some podcasts, check out the Star Talk podcast, and then maybe some of those online documentaries as well.
Don, thank you very much for the call. I got to say, you know, when I was a kid, we had four channels, really. And with cable, if you want to, you can watch a very well-done astronomy show almost every night. And it's so great for your education. Do you find your students are smarter now?
You know, they see a lot of stuff on YouTube, you know, before I expect them to. So, yeah, they definitely come in with more knowledge than they ever did before. You know, sometimes it gets a little dangerous because not everything on YouTube is accurate.
Oh,
so there are some misconceptions that you brew for a while. But in general, they are so knowledgeable already. And it's great because they're just itching to learn more. And they love to have a professional in front of them where they can ask those tough questions. You know, you can't ask a YouTube video a question, but a person, of course, you can. So they just love having that experience.
What amazes you most to this day? Now, you're a professional. You are looking at these things all the time, and you are ensconced in all of the research. What amazes you to this day?
You know, I think the thing that I am most amazed at is the sheer number of planets that we are finding around other stars. Like, I think we always expected that there'd be a few other solar systems out there. But, you know, we found on the order of like 5,000, and we've only been looking for the past 20 years, which means that there's got to be tons and tons of planets out there. And the number of planets that might be like Earth, it blows my mind that apparently these planets and stars form so easily. And I'm just continually fascinated every day when my phone dings and says a new planet has been discovered. There's just always more to know. And they're all relatively close to home. You know, a lot of these stars are not that far away relative to the scale of the Milky Way. So maybe someday we can travel to them. I don't know. I got big dreams for that kind of stuff, too.
Dr. Valerie,
I think that's what fascinates me.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest, and we'll get right back to the phones at 800-348-2551. But given the number of stars, number of planets they keep finding, and they keep finding more and more and more, does it concern you, surprise you, or not neither? That we really haven't found any signals. We haven't. Nobody seems to be sending us signals saying, "Hey, we're here."
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think back to all the things that had to go exactly right to create life on this planet, it maybe doesn't surprise me that other planets either don't have the life or don't have the type of life that we do that are willing and able to communicate. So I'm not super surprised that we haven't found anything yet, but I'm optimistic that we definitely will someday.
Our number here is 800-348-2551, and back to the phones we go. Kathy in Saratoga. Hello, Kathy.
Hello. I just have a question because I called up maybe about a year ago, and I wanted to know about a telescope to purchase, and Mr. Burr really helped me out, and I still have it here. It's a wonderful decoration in my living room, but I got it mostly together, but I still really need somebody to help me put the rest and just learn how to use it. I don't know if there's a place I can call or a course I can take.
Yeah. Do you happen to know what type of telescope it is?
Yeah.
I think Kathy.
We might have lost Kathy.
Got disconnected, but if she calls back, she probably went to look at what brand of telescope she had and hung up the phone. Well, if she calls back, we'll get her on there. Meantime, Glenn is in Rotterdam. Glenn, you're on.
Yes. Good afternoon, Doctor. We've recently, the U.S. has recently established a space force, military.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you or any of the state colleges participating in that? And, I mean, do we really need a space force? I mean, do we have to defend ourselves against Klingons or other Earthlings? I don't understand why we have something like this. If you could explain, I'll hang up.
All right. Thank you, Glenn. Go ahead.
Yeah. The Space Force is fairly new, and I know it's really mostly a military operation. I am not directly involved, nor do I think anybody here at SUNY Oneonta is involved. I would imagine that there would be partnerships between the government and universities going forward, especially when it comes to technology, whether it's developing telescopes or space flight or any of that kind of stuff. But as to whether or not we need it, I mean, when it comes to, you know, keeping an eye on the skies for missiles and war and stuff, that's definitely important. But also keeping an eye on the skies for asteroids and having a plan if we figure out that one is flying towards us and going to hit us soon, I would imagine the Space Force might play a big role in something like that. So there are a lot of natural dangers out there that we should be preparing for. You know, I don't think the Klingons are going to land and kill us anytime soon, but a rock might come by and do some nasty stuff. So I think that's where we need to focus.
You know, you bring up the asteroid situation, and I remember hearing that there is a plan, and it may have been launched already, to gently nudge an asteroid and just see what happens, which seems like a dangerous gambit. But where are we with that project?
You know, there was a lot of talk not too long ago about, you know, practicing nudging an asteroid or even actually capturing one and putting it in orbit around the moon so that we could study it more. I haven't seen anything about us actually testing it out, but I know that they are actively planning on some sort of design or contraption that could do it, because you might have seen Apophis coming by on Friday, and it's going to be plenty far away, so none of our listeners should get nervous. But we do need to have a plan if that rock gets any closer to us. And if we just send a spacecraft up there to get close enough, the gravitational pull between the spacecraft and the asteroid is just enough to nudge it a little to the left and keep us out of harm's way. So it doesn't take a lot to shift the asteroid as long as we can do it with enough lead time, right? If it's right in our face, we're in trouble. But if we can nudge the asteroid when it's out by Mars or Jupiter, then we're going to be a lot safer. So I think they're still working on it. I haven't seen any test runs of any plans yet, though.
But what if something goes wrong? What if you nudge in the wrong direction? Then it comes right at us. Yeah.
Right. That's the danger. And I think why we don't want to experiment too much, because we can go and, you know, disrupt the orbits of all sorts of stuff in space. But if we make a mistake and nudge it the wrong way, then we make our life worse. So we just have to, you know, make sure we do the calculations right and are as careful as possible with it.
Yeah, I mean, you probably played pool in a bar room, and, you know, the best laid plans, you think you got this thing lined up, it goes the other direction.
Right.
All right, let's go to Dave in Connecticut. Dave, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question, maybe two. It's puzzled me for a while. Why, when the moon rises, it appears so large, and as it gets higher in the sky, it gets smaller and smaller and gets its normal size?
Yeah, that is mostly a perception issue. And they've done quite a few studies on this. So when you look at the moon in the sky and it's very low, you're perceiving the size of the moon in comparison to trees and buildings and other things that you can see really low in the sky. And that makes it seem as if it is comparable in size to those objects, and it's really large. When it gets higher in the sky, you have nothing to compare it to, and it looks a lot smaller to you. But you can do the test. You can hold your pinky up, and regardless of whether the moon is low on the horizon or straight above your head, your pinky should cover up the moon. And if it doesn't cover up the moon, then something's really weird is happening to the moon and we're in big trouble. But it always should be the same size and your pinky finger should be able to cover it up. So it'll prove that the moon actually isn't changing size.
So it's kind of an optical illusion then.
Yeah, very much so.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. What about atmospheric lensing? Say, you know, you have a temperature inversion. Can the size of stars or the brightness of stars change because we have cold air trapped below hot air?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. The stars themselves, they're not really going to change size too much. They might twinkle a bit more if you've got all those effects going on. The moon and the sun, you might see more of a blurry edge, and they might get a little bit bigger. But in general, the objects are so far away that you're not going to see too much of a size change effect.
It's Astronomy Today. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And Susan in Kingston. Susan, you're on.
Hello. Thank you. I love this show. Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you, Doctor, for being a female astronomer.
You are welcome.
I just have a question. I have a question about what to say to people who believe in the flat Earth theory. I have no idea what to say, but I wondered if you could ask.
That's something that we deal with a lot. You know, I get a lot of emails from people asking all sorts of questions on the conspiracy theory and, you know, flat Earth side of things. You know, they've done a lot of studies that show that trying to show people evidence doesn't always work, doesn't always convince them that they're wrong. So I often, you know, let them talk a little bit and kind of listen to what they say. And if there is something that I can point out that they can observe every day and talk about the fact that, you know, yes, it looks like it's flat around us, but we are on such a small scale compared to the size of things. And think about what happens when you're on an airplane. You can almost see how there's a curvature to the Earth. So trying to point out, you know, small things that they themselves can observe. And even if they kind of push you off initially, you might put something in their brain where they're going to pay attention and they're going to rethink it the next time they experience it. So trying to connect with them and show them things that they can experience on an everyday basis helps a little bit.
Susan, thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's Astronomy. At what altitude, assuming we had an SR-71 or a plane that could go really high, at what altitude will you see the curvature of the Earth?
Yeah, I think you've got to get pretty high. A lot of people do tests with balloons where they go up, gosh, I think it's close to the space line, like 100 kilometers or so. I want to say 90 kilometers rings a bell where you can really start to photograph the curvature. You've got to get pretty high. A standard airplane isn't going to get you enough curvature to really perceive it yourself without some measurements.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. And a few emails here. This one came in from Aaron. And Aaron says, I believe two theories on the end of the universe are known as the Big Crunch and the Big Freeze. They are counterpoint theories to the Big Bang. Essentially, they focus on whether matter would concentrate back to the Big Bang once again, or would the momentum from the Big Bang disperse matter distant enough for the force of gravity to be too weak to reconsolidate to the Big Bang again. Either one of those strike you as true?
Well, both of them are legitimate possibilities. I think most scientists are leaning more towards the freeze than the crunch at the moment. Because when we look at things in outer space, we see all of the galaxies moving away, which, you know, ultimately led us to the Big Bang theory and all of that. But we also notice that the further away we look, the faster the objects are moving away from us. So the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And that means that it could potentially continue to accelerate and grow forever. That would lead us to the Big Freeze, where we ultimately get so large and everything has separated so much that there's no more heat. Everything kind of separates, cools off, and we settle down to absolute zero. The Big Crunch, on the other hand, would require gravity to take over again. Some force, this dark energy, seems to be counteracting gravity and growing our universe. But gravity would have to take over and start to pull things close together again for us to go through this crunch and potentially another bang and another creation of the universe. That doesn't seem like it's happening, but that's the case today. You know, we don't know what's going to happen a few billion years from now.
Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us. This email from Marion Delmar. I've been hearing a lot of astronomers being referred to as astrophysicists in recent years. When I asked an astronomer friend what's behind that, she said it was due to confusion. Oh, it was to reduce confusion between astronomers and astrologers. You've run into that problem, I'm sure. I have well-educated friends who on some level believe in astrology. My response is generally to roll my eyes and say nothing. What do you do when people start telling you about their sign when you tell them you're an astronomer? And that is from Marion Delmar. That doesn't happen, right?
Never. No, I politely say that I am not an astrologer and that I know nothing about their sign and their personality and all of that. But, you know, the constellations are there. There is a little bit of an astronomy link. And, you know, I try and share some information about how they can go find their astronomical sign in the sky. But that's about it.
Okay.
So, yeah, we definitely get confused with astrologers every once in a while. But as we mentioned with all those YouTube videos, you know, people are starting to understand more the difference between astronomers and astrologers. So it's happening less and less to me.
But Mary's point is a good one. An astronomer is an astrophysicist?
Yeah. So usually we call we refer to an astronomer as somebody who does more observing, maybe an amateur astronomer who focuses on small telescopes observing the night sky. Astrophysicists usually have some education or training. Most professional astronomers will refer to themselves as an astrophysicist and not just an astronomer. But there's no hard-cut distinction. And, you know, nobody gets offended if you call them an astrophysicist versus an astronomer. But that's usually the difference. Astronomers are more the observational type, and astrophysicists are more the professional research type.
Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us. Val, we'll take a quick break here, and then we'll hit the home stretch. 800-348-2551 is our number. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the number. Astronomy with Valerie Rapson. Pete writes, hey, what makes anyone assume that other life will not be hostile? Maybe we are safer being hidden. What do you think?
Yeah. I think we've all watched too many sci-fi movies that tell us that maybe contacting the aliens is not a great idea. We have no idea whether the aliens are smarter, dumber than we are, if they're hostile, if they're nice. I think we just cross our fingers and hope that they're either, you know, microbial to the point where they're not going to really hurt us in any way, or they are kind and just intrigued by, you know, who we are and the fact that we exist with them in the universe. So I think it's just pure hope that they're friendly if we find them.
Well, if they're there, they're very, very far away. I mean, for travel, realistic travel to occur, there will have to be some sort of a new understanding of physics. Do you think that the speed of light is surmountable in some way?
Well, we can't technically get past the speed of light, but when we get close to the speed of light, we can use Einstein's theories of relativity, and we can actually contract space. So we're not so much going faster than light. We're actually just making the distance between us and the planet that we want to go to a lot shorter than it normally would. And that is physics that we understand and know to be true. It's really now the engineering of accelerating ourselves to that speed and being able to maintain that speed for long periods of time to actually see those effects in action.
Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today. And Dylan is in West Hurley. Dylan, you're on.
Hey, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a 10-inch Dobsonian telescope, and so recently I've been fighting with the moon to get some good deep space objects, and I'm kind of also just lost on the good ones to see, and I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Yeah, definitely. Well, a 10-inch telescope is an excellent one. You're going to be able to see lots of galaxies and clusters and things like that. I would start by, you know, taking a look at the Messier objects. A lot of those are not technically deep sky, but there's 110 of those, and you can look at the different ones that are available in the different seasons. Obvious ones to start with are the Pleiades, because you can just make sure that you can find it with your eyes and see it first. But coming up, there's going to be a lot of stuff in the spring and summer sky. You can look at the cluster in Hercules, a lot of the planetary nebula that are coming up. So that's what I would suggest. Mm-hmm. Start with the Messier catalog if you haven't yet, and then start going for galaxies too. You know, Andromeda Galaxy, things like that are definitely great deep sky objects.
Oh, yeah. Any, like, classic spirally ones?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Andromeda Galaxy is a nice classic spiral. I don't have them, honestly, all memorized off the top of my head. But you can definitely, you know, just Google galaxies visible in springtime, and you'll get a nice list. And just don't expect it to look exactly like the Hubble Space Telescope picture. But if you can see some spirals in that, you'll definitely be able to see some nice spirals, even with your 10-inch telescope.
Dylan, thanks a lot for the call. You know, we had this conversation at my house within the last couple of weeks. We were looking at some pictures from the Hubble, and they're mm-hmm. beautiful colors. Are those pictures all false colors?
So they're false colors in the sense that there is not a color camera on Hubble. We use glass filters that only allow one color of light through at a time, and then we combine the colors together to get the pretty image on the computer. But with Hubble, a lot of the colors that you see are what your eyes would see if your eyes were as big as the Hubble Space Telescope. So they're not false in that sense. We just have to, you know, combine them on the computer to bring out the colors a little bit more. For telescopes that observe, say, in the infrared or the X-ray, in colors that our eyes are not sensitive to, that's when we really get into the false color imagery, where we're artificially assigning red or blue or green to a certain wavelength of light to make an aesthetically pleasing image, but it's not what your eyes would actually see.
Mm. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today. The number is 800-348-2551. This email from Mark is an interesting one, and then we'll go back to the phones. Mark is in Colony, and the subject heading is Measuring Distance to Moon and Sun by the Ancients. Using the Pythagorean theorem, I might be able to calculate the distance. But how did the ancients estimate the distance, and about when was that first measurement made?
Yeah, so they definitely did exactly what he's describing, Pythagorean theorem, trigonometry. All you have to do is you've got to know the distance to one thing or another, right? So they would observe things like the transit of Venus or the transit of Mercury, and they would be able to get relative distances between the planets and the sun, and then with the moon as well. With the moon, it's a little bit different. It's a lot closer, so there are other things that you can do to kind of estimate the distance. But they were able to do it, gosh, I don't remember the earliest date. I know we had the size of the Earth in BC times, but maybe shortly after that we were able to calculate the distances. And it's just simple trig with observing other planets and observing our own planet and being able to do relative scales.
Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us today. Astronomy on Vox Pop. Joe is in Schenectady. Joe, you're on.
Hi. I'm wondering if the constellations have any real practical scientific value. And if so, were there serious astronomers that kind of discovered them, or was it a crazy witch doctor somewhere?
No, that's a great question. So what's interesting is, you know, when we talk about constellations, we colloquially refer to constellations as the connect the dots pictures in the sky, right? Orion is the constellation where I play connect the dots and I get the outline of a man. But scientifically, constellations are technically a region of a sky. What I tell my students is think of a constellation not as individual stars, but like a state within the United States. It's a region of a much larger portion of the sky. So in that sense, they are scientific. We break up the night sky into 88 different sections and then refer to stars within a certain constellation. But I think what you're referring to is, you know, actually making the pictures, and those just have their roots in different cultural stories, right? We go by the Greek and Roman ones, but there's a whole different set of Native American ones, Chinese ones. The ancient astronomers came up with their own patterns and their own stories to go along with it, and there's not a ton of science directly related to those patterns, but there is when you think of them in a sense of, you know, breaking up the sky into different patches and where does the sun fall and things like that.
Joe, thank you very much for the call, and Patrick is in Craigsmore. Patrick, you're on.
Hi. I just have a question about the moonlight at night. Lately, I have a lot of snow still at my house. And if I get up in the night when the moon is bright, it looks blue. And I'm wondering if that's a reflection or what.
Yeah. So with the snow on the ground, it's naturally going to look a lot brighter, right? Snow has what we call high albedo. It reflects the moonlight. So it's naturally going to make your ambient sky look a little bit more blue even at night. So you have the effect of the moonlight coming through, which is primarily white, a little bit more on the yellowish red end, but you perceive it as white. And then you've got this additional ambient reflected light that's going to cause things like the moon to potentially look a little bit more blue. So it's a combination of just naturally observing the moon and having that additional subtle glow around you because of the snow.
Well, it's actually the snow that looks blue.
It's the snow that looks blue. Interesting. Yeah, so I guess let's see.
All week while the moon has been out, it's been very blue at night. It's beautiful, but it's a little eerie. And I was just wondering if that was some kind of visual reflective quality of the moon or what. But.
Right. I think it's more of a reflective quality of the snow itself, because the light that you're getting from the moon is primarily white light. Some of the blue light is scattered in the atmosphere as it passes through. And then when it reflects off of another white material, you again get additional blue light scattering. Just like the atmosphere scatters the blue light, the snow is going to do something similar. So it's just reflection off the snow.
Patrick, thanks for the call. You know, the other night when the moon was very bright, one of my kids said, hey, can you hurt your eyes looking at the moon like you can when you look at the sun? And, you know, I said no, but am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. If you look at the moon with a telescope, sometimes it almost feels as if it's hurting your eyes.
Yeah.
But it's not anywhere close to the brightness of the sun. So if you're looking at the moon with a standard, you know, small telescope, 4, 6, 8 inches, it might feel extra bright, but it's really fine. You know, maybe if you had like a 2-meter telescope and you stared at the moon, that might be a little, you know, blinding for a short time, but the level of light you get off the moon is far different than the level of light of the sun.
Let's go back to the phones. Ken is in Albany. Ken, you're on.
Hello. I have a question about astronomy facilities at SUNY Oneonta. That's a little bit different than you had at Dudley. In particular, do you have free access to the 1-meter Dob, the Dobsonian that's mobile? There, it's for the audience, is apparently the largest optical telescope in New York State. Is it SUNY Oneonta?
Yes, it definitely is. And that's one of the reasons why I was enticed to, you know, come here, is because they have an amazing facility at this place called College Camp. I don't remember exactly how many, I think I counted at least 10 while I was up there last, of different size telescopes inside of domes. And you're right, we have a 1-meter, 40-inch telescope literally on wheels that we can roll in and out of the garage and use at will. So, you know, once COVID has, you know, calmed down a little bit more, we plan to open back up for public viewing, inviting people up there to use and look through this telescope, because it's really wonderful. And I want to get more people up there to see it.
I'd love to have one of those in my garage. Another question about the NTT 40. Does it have a built-in CCD camera, or do you need to hook up some additional optics in order to take photographs?
Yeah. So all of the telescopes, you have to add the camera to them. It's not technically built into the system, but nowadays it's so easy to just, you know, screw on the camera and add it there. So we have the ability to let people look through it with their eyes with an eyepiece, or we can put a camera on that telescope and take pictures as well. So we can do both.
Ken, thank you very much for the call. Now, you say you have a 40-inch telescope in a garage. Knowing how delicate some of these can be, how often do you have to realign and recalibrate the thing?
Yeah, you know, because of the style, it's more of a Dobsonian style where it's sitting in this big base. It doesn't have to be recalibrated all that often. I mean, when you take it out with the tractor, it does get jostled around a little bit. But the mirrors are pretty secure, so we always do a little bit of an adjustment to make sure things are lined up right away. But the big adjustment of aligning the mirrors, you usually only have to do that once or twice a year, unless you hit a big bump.
You know, I really didn't know that you had so many telescopes at SUNY Oneonta, and the skies can get so dark, too. It's beautiful there.
It's spectacular. I cannot wait to get them out again for people to see.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson joins us, Astronomy Today. Henry in Saratoga. Henry, you're on.
Hi. So I wanted to ask, so a lot of my friends are talking about how, you know, 2020 has been so bad, and it's because of Mercury in retrograde and all of these things. Geez. And I was wondering if there's any science behind celestial bodies actually affecting our moods, our day-to-day activities, et cetera.
Right. Well, the short answer is no. But the slightly longer answer is that, you know, people have been looking into this. I hear this all the time. My mom is a nurse, and she would always say, oh, the full moon, the ER is going to be busy, right? You know, there's always these things that we hear about. But astronomically, you know, Mercury cannot really affect our Earth in any way that's important. And it's not, we don't think it's affecting the human brain, at least not in any way that we've ever been able to figure out neurologically. So it might seem that way, but I think it's just, you know, people notice the full moon or the retrograde Mercury, and then they associate it with everything bad that's happening.
Yeah.
But bad things are happening all the time. Mm-hmm. They just don't link the two up. So.
Boy, you got that right. That's a great answer. Bad things are happening all the time. Mercury is always in retrograde. Kevin in Northfield. Kevin, you're on.
Yeah, how you doing? Can you hear me okay?
Sure thing. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So I had kind of a strange dream one time. I guess you can call it a nightmare, where the asteroid had slammed into the moon. Moon disappeared out of view, and all of the oceans became still. And I was just wondering what would actually happen if something like that did happen.
Oh, yeah. We'd be in trouble. We definitely need our moon for a lot of reasons. And the big one is the tides, right? If the moon goes away, the tides go away. That's going to have a major effect on the marine life and the ecosystem down there, because the motion of the water will change. That will have a resulting change on the weather patterns and the heating of the oceans and the transfer of the heat to the atmosphere. That'll disrupt the water cycle. Oh, my gosh. It would be just terrible.
Interesting.
So we definitely don't want the moon to get destroyed.
Now, that's a great question, Kevin, and thank you for that. And so are you then suggesting that if there was no moon, there is no life possible, or would just life be different?
Well, that's what we think. Those that study how life emerged on Earth think that the moon played a really crucial role. We think that the earliest life actually formed in tide pools, the places where the water slashes in and out near the edge of a lake or an ocean. And since that's where we see life, we think the motion of that water and the small climate that happens within that location allowed life to form. And had the moon not existed, we're not sure that microbial life could have formed in the first place.
Hmm. So as we search for planets that potentially have life, then do we have to narrow down our search to those that have moons?
Well, that's something they've considered. I mean, it's not a guarantee that you can't have life if you don't have a moon, but we're learning more and more about how important our moon was, so it will help us narrow down places to look in the future, I think. If a planet has a big moon, I think there's even a higher likelihood that life could be there.
Fascinating. And our moon is moving away from us little by little, right?
Yeah, like 2 to 3 centimeters a year, I think it is.
And what happens just when it's too far away? Will it stay with us, or will it just float out into space?
Well, I mean, for a very long time, it will still be attached to us gravitationally. Eventually, like billions of years from now, it'll be gone. The first thing we'll notice, though, is that we won't be able to have total solar eclipses, because as the moon gets further away, it looks ever so slightly smaller in our sky, and eventually it won't be big enough to cover up the sun.
No.
So our future ancestors won't be able to view solar eclipses.
All right, let's go. We have time for maybe one more here with Dr. Valerie Rapson. Let's go to Dan in Ballston Lake. Dan, you're on. About a minute here.
Hi, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. I just started reading a book by the physicist Avi Loeb. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
Yes.
Yes, and his theory of the asteroid Oumuamua.
Yep.
And I was wondering what his theory is, that it was not an asteroid, but it was actually a visitor from outer space. And do you have an opinion on whether it was actually an asteroid or or extraterrestrial?
What's your opinion?
So I'm kind of leaning against the alien theory as much as I want it to be aliens. You know, this thing came in, and the tricky part is as it passed by the sun, it then started to accelerate as it left, almost like a solar sail or somebody turned on the engines. So that's why some scientists are thinking that it could be extraterrestrial. But this also happens with comets, where they outgas, and that extra push of the gases coming out can accelerate the objects.
Right.
So I'm leaning more towards the obvious terrestrial solutions, but you know, we're still exploring and we're still trying to figure out exactly what we saw.
Well, Dr. Valerie Rapson, we are done. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Love being on the show.
And we'll talk to you soon. Support comes from Interim Healthcare, thanking their caregivers working to help people remain safe in their homes, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga. InterimHealthcare.com. At Baba Louie's Pizza, Great Barrington and Hudson, New York, keeping comfort food available with curbside pickup in Hudson and Great Barrington Thursday through Monday. Gift certificates available. BabaLouie'sPizza.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Valerie Rapson of SUNY Oneonta for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for calling. Many apologies to all of those left on the line today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Allie Peterson answered the calls today. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, okay, get your computer questions ready, because tomorrow our buddy Tony Yang joins us, and he will solve all of those vexing technical issues, or at least try. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for 51%.